Hello and welcome to the Region Agri podcast, the go-to place to hear everything about regenerative agriculture. Region Agri is an initiative supporting farms, agribusinesses and the supply chain in their transition to regenerative approaches. We offer global capability with the aim of securing the health of the land and the wealth of those who live on it. For more information about our initiative and to find out how we can help you with your regenerative journey, please visit regionagri.org. I'm your host, Rose Riley, and once again, I'm excited to bring you the latest developments on the global phenomenon that is regenerative agriculture. In this episode, our focus is the biodiverse benefits of regenerative farming. To share insights into this topic, I'm joined by Andrew Christie, agronomist and agrotechnologist at the Crop Soil Environmental Research Centre, the James Hutton Institute, along with Michael Kavanagh, regenerative mixed farmer and co-founder of the Nature and Carbon Investment Community Green Farm Collective. The James Hutton Institute combines strengths in crop, soil, land use and environmental research and makes a major contribution to the understanding of key global issues such as food, energy and environmental security, and developing and promoting effective technological and management solutions to these. The Institute is an internationally networked organisation and operates from multiple sites, including two main sites in Scotland at Aberdeen and Dundee. It employs more than 500 scientists and support staff, making it one of the biggest research centres in the UK and the first of its type in Europe. Andrew's joined the podcast to tell us more about the James Hutton Institute and its ongoing research, particularly the findings of its large-scale regenerative crop trials following the successful completion of a second six-year rotation. Green Farm Collective membership community was founded by a group of six UK Soil Health Farmer of the Year award finalists and winners who focus on regenerative farming practices and believe in its benefits of reduced pesticides, increased carbon capture and improved biodiversity. Michael, co-founder of the collective, has been striving to improve soil health and biodiversity across a 700 hectare mixed sheep and arable farm in Shropshire in the UK. Michael has successfully transitioned to fully regenerative practices over the last 8 years, now farming with zero tillage and without the use of synthetic inputs. He's here to share more about the Green Farm Collective and the biodiversity improvements he's seen on farm. Welcome to the podcast, Andrew and Michael. I'm excited to learn more about your experience and personal journeys with regenerative agriculture.
Good afternoon, Rose. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming, guys. So to start with, Andrew, could we have an introduction to the James Hutton Institute?
So the James Hutton Institute, we're a world-leading scientific organisation working on interdisciplinary land-based research, named after a key figure of the Scottish Enlightenment, James Hutton, who was the father of modern geology, but also he was an agriculturalist as well, and he had his own farm down in the Borders. We conduct work in plant breeding. We also have our social scientists looking at rural communities, and then the more traditional chemists and biologists. We have an important resource for research here on the east coast of Scotland, where we can host trials in the lab, in our glasshouse facilities, but also with our field space on farms as well, where we can offer our arable farms at the Dundee site and a grassland farm up at Glensoch in Aberdeenshire. But my role as agronomist and agri-tech specialist is closer to the farmer and the applied science part. I feel that's an important role as it's the link between research and practical agriculture. It's a privilege, I think, to be in this position and be able to work with both farmers and researchers, although it sometimes can be two different languages we're talking.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. And Michael, could you give us an introduction to the Green Farm Collective?
Yeah, sure. Brief bit of my background. So I'm not actually from a farming background, so I'm a newbie to the industry, as it were. I've sort of worked in various farm management jobs, and I've been in this current job now for 8.5 years. We've transitioned from a very conventional system to what is now what I would class as a regenerative farming system. We're farming about 1700 acres, predominantly arable, but also with about 650 ewe sheep enterprise. The Green Farm Collective, as you ask about, is basically myself and five other farmers who, 2 or 3 years ago, we could see the very murky waters approaching us of the new era of trading natural capital, and actually how farmers were going to diversify their incomes when the BPS check disappeared, so the UK subsidy check disappeared. We were all either winners or runners-up of the Soil Farmer of the Year competition. And there's six farmers with, we hope, some integrity and some trust in the farming world. We realised that was a valuable asset and got together to form the Green Farm Collective. really as a way of trying to navigate our way through the murky waters of trading natural capital. And that's what we've done and that's what we're doing. We're at the stage now where we are trading carbon, we are trading biodiversity, private biodiversity trades. And the next step for us is trading regeneratively farmed produce as well. So there's an awful lot going on with the Green Farm Collective. It's exciting times for us.
And can you talk us through your journey with regenerative farming on farm so far?
Yeah, sure. So when I started here at Church Farm 8.5 years ago, I inherited a very conventionally farmed system. I had worked on very conventional farms throughout my career, and that's all I really knew. However, I faced the problem when I came here that I needed to farm what back then was 500 acres of arable. And how I did that on my own was the first sort of problem to bridge to cross. And I did that by adopting a strip till system, which meant that I could establish all of our crops on our own whilst minimising labour and fuel and machinery costs. And really, after doing that for 3 or 4 years and seeing the soil health benefits of it, it started to turn my head and realize that there is another way. And alongside this, I was also aware that we as arable farmers, we were losing our chemical inventory every year. We were losing things. And it was very clear to me that in my farming lifetime, I was going to be faced with this problem even more and more. So I was very keen to learn how to farm without them while I'd still got them to fall back upon. And if you fast forward 8 years, it's been a complete shift in the way that we're farming and also importantly the way my brain works, because I can now see that there is another way of farming where we don't rely heavily on all the chemicals that we're so used to, and we work with Mother Nature far more. And actually, it turns out that we can, importantly, produce large amounts of food, because that's what farmers should do, first and foremost. But as a happy consequence of the system, we can also help biodiversity thrive and recover alongside producing food, which those two things running together, I think, are a fantastic combination, really.
And how are you managing your livestock on the farm?
So we're running about 650 ewes. We don't use any concentrate feeds at all. So the flock health is purely managed by either grazing our cover crops or grazing grassland. Sheep are rotationally grazed. I would love to mob graze, but just haven't quite got the labour or the setup to be able to do that. But that's not to say it'll never happen. So and all of our lambs are finished on farm, and most of them are finished on cover crops. Some of the early ones will be finished on grass, and they're all going into a local farm shop. Local farm shop loves them because they're having more and more customers who are recognizing the benefits of grass or forage fed, both beef and lamb, to be honest. And the more and more customers are asking for it, so they're paying a premium for it, and it's a great relationship for us. So all of our lamb actually goes into Essington Farm Shop.
That's interesting to hear. We've had conversations in the podcast previously about the relationship between how an animal is reared and then what flavour you get in the meat. Do you think your customers are seeing that difference, that they're seeing an improved flavour or texture in the lamb?
Yeah, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. It's well documented that grass-fed lamb, yes, it might be slightly older and it might have taken slightly longer to get to a point where it's ready to be butchered, but certainly the health benefits and the taste benefits are certainly there. And actually, it's probably more prominent in a beef carcass, but seeing a grass-fed beef carcass compared to a grain-fed beef carcass hung up, the visual difference in them is massive. The yellowing in the fat of the grass-fed compared to just the bland white in the grain-fed. I know I'm fully aware that I'm biased, but any taste test I've ever done, the grass-fed has come out miles ahead, to be honest. And at the end of the day, it's what the consumer is asking for as well. So, you know, we're supplying the consumer what they want.
Yeah, that's great to hear that the consumer is recognising the difference there. And you mentioned cover crops. What crops are you growing on the farm?
Yeah, so our arable rotation, we're growing milling wheats on feed wheats, milling oats, malting barley, feed beans, oilseed rape, and quinoa. or quinoa if you shop at Waitrose. So that's for the British Quinoa Company, traditionally a South American crop. Mm-hmm. But you know, we're proving that we can grow these crops here in the UK. And obviously the food miles, the carbon footprint of my quinoa grown here in Shropshire, so sold locally, is fantastic. We are also growing usually an 8 or 10 species cover crop. So in front of all of our spring crops, we grow an 8 or 10 species cover crop. And I usually select the species on of those cover crops, depending on what job I'm trying to do with them. So quite a lot of the time, I want them to be 50% doing a job for my soil health and 50% feeding my sheep. Because obviously I'm feeding all my cover crops to my own sheep, so I get the benefit of them. So yeah, it's usually a 10 species cover crop that I grow.
And how are you integrating the sheep into the arable system, and what benefits or challenges indeed are you seeing with that?
Yeah, certainly it's certainly an awful lot of benefits. I mean, the benefits of growing cover crops are well documented, but we're now, our soil health is improving massively year on year, and it's all part of the jigsaw puzzle. I talk about the fact that I'm no longer using insecticides, fungicides, plant growth regulators, chemical seed dressings, reducing nitrogen, applied nitrogen, and all of those things, integrating livestock and cover crops, they're all interrelated. So yeah, the sheep definitely have a massive benefit to our system. We do also sometimes graze cash crops. So if we've got a very forward wheat crop in the wintertime, we will also graze the wheat with our sheep. And actually, we've had really positive results from that as well. Something I'll probably do more of in the future.
And you started off talking about reducing chemical usage. How have you managed to transition away from using insecticides, and what pest control methods are you having to replace?
To be honest, insecticides was the easiest one to do for me. On the home farm here, we're lucky that we've got relatively small field sizes. We've done an awful lot of hedge laying on the farm. We've got lots of ponds, grass margins, things like that. So we've got a lot of habitats for predators. And essentially, that's the no insecticide thing is basically about putting nature back in balance, so that you've got the predators there to eat, you know, to keep everything in balance, and make sure that, you know, that the nasties, the aphids, don't come and eat your crops. Mm-hmm. It's also very much about giving the plant its optimum health, because a plant is no different to a human being. If we're in optimum health, then we're far less likely to be taken down by a disease or attacked by a pest, and a plant is no different. So ensuring that plant is as healthy as it possibly can be helps keep the pests away from them. So insecticides was it really wasn't a scary thing for me at all. I just, to be honest, day one went cold turkey on them. The one year, I can't remember what year it was now, probably 6 or 7 years ago, we had a little bit of BYDV about, but it was a year when everyone had BYDV about, and it really didn't harm us at all. And ever since then, touch wood, I've never had a problem, and insecticides are a really easy one for me to drop, to be honest.
Fantastic. And what about the other chemicals that were being used on farm before then?
There's obviously chemical seed dressings, there's plant growth regulators, there's fungicides are sort of the main ones. Fungicides is one that I personally haven't quite cracked yet. I've got an awfully long way with it, but haven't quite cracked. There are people, other guys in the Green Farm Collective who have nailed it. And it's about optimizing plant health. So I'm ensuring that, you know, we're tissue testing, we're giving the plant exactly the right nutrition that it needs. I'm using quite a lot of silicon as well. Silicon strengthens the cell wall of plants, so therefore makes the plant more impervious to pest and disease. Obviously, strengthening the cell wall also helps with the straw rigidity, so we're not having to use the plant growth regulators. So I think silicon's a big part of the jigsaw. I'm also brewing up biology on farm, which when I first heard about brewing up biology on farm, I thought it sounded just a little bit too much of a stretch. But the first time I tried it was at T3 fungicide timing against Fusarium. And you add bacteria to 1,000 litre IBC, give it a food source, essentially bubble it up, put oxygen through it so that bacteria multiplies, and you then spray it on your crop. And depending on the rate that you're using, it costs you between £1.50 and £3 a hectare, so minimal cost. The first time I used it, obviously I trialed it in an area of the field and then had the seed tested. Where we'd used the biology, it came back as 0% fusarium. Where I hadn't used the biology, it came back as 17% fusarium. So that was the catalyst to me using that as a routine throughout my spray program. And actually those, the different bacteria do a whole host of different things, anywhere from essentially eating fusarium to fixing nitrates out of the air. The atmosphere is 78-79% nitrogen, and actually they are capable of fixing those out of the atmosphere. So the biology is, all these things I talk about are small jigsaw pieces, and not one of them on their own will sort of work, as it were. It's how they all fit in together.
Brilliant, thank you for explaining that. And in terms of transitioning, what are the main kind of learnings and challenges of regenerative transition, and how do you plan to apply those over the next 800 acres?
Yeah, really interesting question. So as you say, we're just in our first year of a new 800 acre farm, and you know, we will be transitioning that farm and hopefully bringing it into line with the existing farm that I've been on for 8 years. I've learned an awful lot from the last 8 years on this farm, and I'm fairly hopeful and optimistic that I'll be able to bring the new farm into line with this farm in less than 8 years because of what I've learned in the 8 years of doing this farm. So one of the most important things, I think, to anyone looking at it is don't rush. Try small baby steps each year. Trial as much as you possibly can on your own farm, because you can look at trials on any other trials anywhere else, and the system is different to what you've got at home. The soils are different, the machinery is different, the climate's different, everything's different. So
absolutely,
don't necessarily believe any trials you see. Try a little bit of it on your own, and then it gives you the confidence to roll that out over a bigger acreage the year after.
Yep.
I'd also say everyone gets transfixed on a zero-till drill. Don't get transfixed on a zero-till drill. Yeah, it's part of the jigsaw that you might want to get to eventually, but actually it's not the be-all and end-all. We probably all agree there's too many farms about that have thought that a zero-till drill is, you know, right, we'll go buy a zero-till drill, we'll become regenerative. And in too many cases, it really doesn't work like that. And, you know, I bought a zero-till drill in 2019, and there's certainly parts of this farm that, when I first went out with that drill, they weren't actually ready for it. I've learned from that, and actually carrying on with strip till and cover cropping and all the other bits that we've talked about for another couple of years, and that soil will get there eventually. But yeah, if you rush things, you can actually send your soils backwards. So really important not to rush things.
What was it about the soil that wasn't ready at that point? Was it the sort of soil health or the structure, or...?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, soil health, soil structure. We're very low organic matter soils here. We're quite sandy soils. If they're not protected by something growing in them or a cover over them, then they run together. I have had in the past where I've been very short of forage for the sheep, I've grazed cover crops too hard. And obviously you get that compaction, and then you can't direct drill into that at all. There's a few things like that I've certainly learned.
Yep.
What not to do, as it were.
Yep. Well, I mean, if there's one thing that we always come back to on this podcast, it's that regenerative is not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's very much about trial and error and finding out what's right and just going on that journey over time, rather than being able to kind of click your fingers and make an overnight change. So really interesting. Thank you. And I'd love to know, of all of the changes that you've made on farm, how have they impacted the biodiversity that you're seeing on the land?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because I 8 years ago, I'd never heard of regen ag or biodiversity or anything like that when I set out on this journey. But what has become clear to me, you know, definitely over the last 5 years, is actually this thriving biodiversity that I now have around me. We have a bird ringing group that come to the farm, and we have bird feeding stations where they'll net and actually put tiny little identification rings on birds and record them. Yep. They also go out at night with thermal imaging cameras and actually catch, they net ground nesting birds, so skylarks, for example. They go out and net them and record the numbers. And actually, we've got an incredibly diverse portfolio of birds living on the farm, but really, really, really encouraging numbers of red data species as well, skylarks, yellowhammers, for example. And we've also got barn owls nesting in the tree in the field out the back of the house just here. We've got all four species of owls two of which we've actually caught and ringed on the farm. Others that we know where they are, as it were. So that's really encouraging to see, because obviously they're eating all the small mammals, and the small mammals are thriving off all the mini beasts, as you might like to call it. And all of that comes from soil health. Everything stems from soil health. So it's really, really encouraging to see this, you know, this thriving bird life. So we have an annual bird report done on the farm, and that's, you know, it's really encouraging to see what we've got here. I didn't set out to achieve it 8 years ago. My mindset has now changed, and I do enjoy seeing that and see it as a really, really positive part of what we're doing farming. But it is just a happy consequence of the way that we're farming, and that's fantastic to see. Yeah, other benefits of the system I've seen on farm. I mean, fuel use has been a big one that's come down massively over the years. When I first started on this farm, we were at 13 litres a hectare. We're down to 6 litres a hectare now. Interestingly, the new farm, we're at 14 litres a hectare this year, so higher than we were here. So a bit more work to do there. We've mentioned soil organic matter. Soil organic matter is crucial to me, because when you consider that 85 to 90% of plant nutrient acquisition is microbially mediated, my brain says to me, okay, make that soil as homely to microbes as is humanly possible. Soil organic matter is both the house and the food source for microbes. So therefore, I want to increase that soil organic matter. We've increased our soil organic matter from 2.5% to 3.25% in 6 years. So I'm really, really pleased with that. And when you consider that for every 0.1% of organic matter increase, you're gaining 16,000 litres per hectare of water holding capacity. That's crucial here on our sandy loam soils. And at the end of the day, we've got healthier crops, and therefore, as we've talked about, we're not having to rely so much on the synthetic inputs that we were having to rely on before. And it's not so much a low input system, I wouldn't say. I'm probably still going through my crops as many times as a conventional system would do. I'm just using different products and ensuring that I'm tailoring those products to the specific needs of the plant. And actually, a happy consequence of that is, you know, my variable costs have gone from a pre-regen farm average of nearly £600 a hectare of variable cost to what is now anywhere between sort of 350 and maybe £400, you know, as an average across the whole farm of variable costs. So there's an awful lot of benefits to the whole system.
And Andrew, I'd love to hear about the regenerative crop trials that the James Hutton Institute is doing and some of the findings that you've been uncovering.
I'd better introduce the platform as a whole to start with. It's the Centre for Sustainable Cropping Platform. And this was before regenerative became the word to call it. It started in 2009 as a field scale comparison of the impact of low input and regenerative techniques against standard agronomic practice. We've developed an holistic approach within an integrated system using these regenerative techniques, including reduced tillage, no tillage, which matches up with what Michael's saying. It's horses for courses in that sense. There's cover and companion cropping brought in, the use of threshold levels rather than blanket sprays, targeted applications, and nutrient budgeting to reduce the reliance on chemical and synthetic interventions and promoting soil health and plant fitness, and because it's the overall health of the system rather than just one aspect. And this is compared on a half field scale within each of the six crops within a rotation against a ploughed system, which is managed in a conventional sense with blanket applications and prescriptive treatments.
And so which crops are being trialled and why were they chosen?
Potatoes, which makes everything difficult for a start. Then we've got, following that, winter wheat, which would traditionally have been after a break crop. Winter barley, winter oilseed rape with the entry from winter barley, followed by beans and then spring barley before potatoes. And before we start talking about the rotation itself, it's an odd rotation and we're quite open about that. The choice of cropping was based on the funding available.
Okay.
And so the importance of each crop was how important it was in a Scottish context and in a UK context, because the main funder was the Scottish government, still is the Scottish government. Okay. And so potatoes, we've got a fantastic seed industry that's been developed up here. So that still is an important part. And we need to make sure that it's a sustainable system that we are producing our seed potatoes within. Spring barley is an obvious one with our malting industry and how important that is locally. And then we could argue that there was an opportunity to have an extra two good crops of winter wheat after break crops, but we've had to squeeze everything in because oilseed rape was important locally, and also beans was important to have a nitrogen-fixing crop within there to look at. So we're looking at the difference in systems rather than rotation.
Okay, so can you tell us a bit more about that work and the differences that you're seeing between the sites?
From the work being led by Cathy Hawes, leader of the CSE platform, I can highlight a couple of papers that have come out from this work which show that there have been differences between the two sides. One of the most important parts, I think, that we have to highlight here is we're now in our 13th year. And so we've had our first two rotations and we're able to then pick up on all the data collected from the first rotation. With this being a long-term platform, we're not just looking at short-term issues which could be affected by likes of weather and spatial variation on a smaller scale. We're looking at the whole rotation, and that brings us to a more reliable conclusion. So if we hone in on the actual transition to regenerative techniques within an integrated system, I can bring forward the cost-benefit analysis carried out by Michaela Roberts with input from Cathy Hawes and Mark Young at the Institute. And looking at the transition, and we're aware that there is a transition, we have to build up the soil health in order to have nature work for us. We need to help nature in a way to get to a stage where there's a synergy within the system. So in the low input regenerative system, we can reduce the environmental impact, but improvements are seen as public goods and not necessarily representing a direct financial benefit. The push for production was all about selling food, maximising food production. And that was a way that it was an obvious incentive that we could make more money by producing more yield.
Mm-hmm.
We have to think of things in a different way when we're transitioning to a more regenerative system. So the long-term benefits of protecting the soil and biodiversity come at a cost short-term with slightly lower yields, but we're seeing this building in the second rotation. So our analysis within this paper was based on that first rotation transitioning. And it was moving away from a chemical input-based system to a lower input agroecological one. So using more sustainable, environmentally friendly practices. So the improved provision of public goods is a bit of a cost to the farmer, is a main conclusion coming out of that. I'll highlight a couple of figures here. There's a bit of a trade-off to go along with the benefit of the public goods, and that within the first rotation of the transition, it shows within the whole rotation, so for the six crops, there was an average of £509 per hectare per year less produced on the integrated side to move towards the regenerative type system. That's not a cost necessarily, but that's a poorer gross margin.
Mm-hmm.
There was a range between different crops, with the beans showing a lower reduction at £199 per hectare per year, and potatoes being a very costly crop to produce anyway, showing £722 per hectare of a difference. And these were just figures for comparison, but we're showing benefits in terms of soil properties and beneficial diversity within crop. So broadleaf weed populations and beneficial broadleaf weeds. So we're able to keep a 10% of total area broadleaf weed incidence, and that's below economic thresholds. But it also provides a benefit to the whole food web and promoting our predators and promoting diversity within the microbial life under the soil as well. An increase in 2% organic matter in the integrated side over the conventional side has been a great thing for us to see, because we've applied huge amounts of compost over the years. And to be able to show that we're building up that organic matter has improved the soil structure. It's improved actually the cation exchange capacity. And so there's a potential to carry more crop and nutrients. It's also providing food for the soil microbes that wasn't there before or had been slightly degraded. Whilst there was costs in transition, we're seeing the benefits now. And in the second rotation, it will be interesting to see how we've managed to close the gap, because we're seeing that the yields are closing. It's come to a stage now where we are no longer significantly different in terms of statistics in five of the six crops, with only winter wheat, which was always slightly poorer in this area with our lighter soils, showing that there was a yield drop in between the two systems. Some interesting things to see in the future. And also it gives us something to work on, and it's an opportunity cost rather than an actual cost. But the potential to earn being lost in terms of a transition, it gives us evidence in that should be incentivized if it's to be a public good in future.
Absolutely. So what other biodiversity and soil health benefits have you come across, whether it's been through the research we've just discussed or other work you've been involved with?
We do have some ongoing trials and work on monitoring field margins, and some it's overlapping hydrology work where we're looking at how margins can be used to help within the water catchment and reduce the flooding. So that's ongoing work, and we're still looking at that. One thing that I can highlight, and I would like to highlight, because it's some of the good work, this is taking me back to my roots, Rose. This is some of the good work that's been carried out with the farm team on the general estate and the commercial part of the farm. And I can talk about our Magic Margins, which was awarded the RSPB Nature of Scotland Awards in the innovation category. So the Magic Margins came about when we were having to think about adding in ecological focus area for our subsidy requirements. And we thought this would be a fantastic opportunity to show some of the work that had been done through the years at the Institute was then being practiced on our Institute farms. There had been tramline runoff trials on a reasonable slope, but nothing too major. And we were amazed at how much leaching and soil erosion had occurred on these tramline trials. And what you would deem not at-risk fields, it made it clear to us that we had to do something to try and stop that. Further work in the Lunan Bay catchment with colleagues in Aberdeen, it was actually my boss, Ewan Caldwell, that had been involved and had watched a presentation on that work. They had brought to light the need for catchment for soil erosion so that it could be caught before it goes into the water course and it then stays in field. So we're not losing nutrients, we're not losing soil off field. Rolling these ideas together and the potential to put in ecological focus areas and margins, we came up with as a team, because everybody did contribute to this, it was a nature-based solution. in that it was low cost and it was semi-permanent, using equipment that we already had. We used potato drill plows across the slope and a tide ridger. Any of your listeners from drier areas in the world might know the tide ridger for making dams in the soil. Adding that in, it helped to hold the water and reduce the runoff. So it's about holding it so that it's not gathering speed going down the hill, mm-hmm. and spreading the water catchment, the catchment of water across the water catchment. Adding vegetation to that helped to stabilize the drills. So mm-hmm. we've tried a few different mixes, like our game cover mixes and wildflower mixes, but these were often short-lived. And the thing that's been most effective for us has been our native species grass mixes. And that's beneficial to our predators, mostly our beetles with the tussocky grass. Simple and effective solution is what it is. We found that if it does silt up, it can be reconfigured as well. So with it being semi-permanent, it wasn't a huge job to fix a problem that had occurred. And once everything's in place, each field has either one in them or one alongside it. And we've seen that we've never had to actually reconfigure them now that they're in place. So they've been established since 2015 and 16. The EFA requirements had stimulated that, but it's brought together a whole heap of things that we'd like to show and show off that was good about the Institute.
Yeah, fantastic. That's it's a really interesting point. I think farming in the UK, water management, whether it's flooding or drought, is becoming increasingly relevant and is obviously hugely relevant to farmers in other areas of the world. So it's really interesting to hear these innovative techniques for increasing the resilience to both drought and flooding in farms.
I should say that it also provided us an extended habitat. Mm. We tried our best to use our fields to create wildlife corridors and make sure that we connected it up with our hedgerow plantings, our forested areas. We keep our stone dikes, which is a feature of the area as well, which also have a value. And what we see is that there's a, using the ecologist term, which I've stolen, it's a heterogeneous microclimate. Okay. And with it being potato drills, there's actually more surface area too, and it's more protected for hosting wildlife habitat.
So I'd like to know now, Michael, you talked earlier about the work of the Green Farm Collective. So how could organisations or farmers or consumers get a bit more involved in the work that you're doing?
So we've just recently launched our membership, Rose. So we've opened our membership up to farmers, on individual advisors and also corporate sponsors, and even to members of the public who might be interested, as to what we're doing. We are hosting an open day here at my farm in Shropshire in Bonningale on the 24th of May. And we've got 19 different speakers at the moment across two different seminar halls. We've got a whole host of sort of like-minded partners, I would say, who are exhibiting here as well. So you get a free lunch as well. We're providing hog roast lunch for everyone, so there's an incentive to come. But I mean, really, what we want other farmers to come and get involved with us for is, well, there's a few reasons. One thing that we haven't talked about today is knowledge exchange, and actually how farmer-to-farmer knowledge exchange is the most crucial thing with all of this regenerative movement or anything that you're doing, really, because I've certainly learned what I've learned over the past 8 years by talking to other farmers. And the more I can do that and the bigger pool of farmers I've got to gather that information from, the faster I will go along my regenerative journey. So that's a big part of what the Green Farm Collective is trying to do. The other thing that we are doing is as I mentioned earlier, we're accessing private biodiversity markets. So, for example, one biodiversity sale that we've done is a flooring company, and they want to be able to show to their customers that they are helping with the global biodiversity crisis. So they have paid to have some cover crops planted and also some wildflower margins planted. So that's private money that we're accessing instead of you know, the countryside stewardship or anything like that. So that's one side of things that we're doing. And then we're also giving our customers, as in the general public, the chance to buy biodiversity as well. So whether it be just a small amount as a Christmas present for someone or anything like that, just very small, low volume, low priced bits of biodiversity. And we'll be launching that initiative on the 24th of May on our open day. So people can buy, a 3x3 square of wildflower meadow or whatever it may be. We are also, so we're quantifying our carbon on farm as well. So we're using Sandy, which is a software by Trinity, to do so. And we're also, and therefore selling carbon credits. We are only selling carbon credits once we've hit net zero ourselves, because that's the only way that I personally can sleep at night. In my view, it's no different to if I've grown 100 tons of wheat and I've got that in the corner of my shed, I can sell it. Equally, if I've grown essentially 100 tons of carbon and I've offset all my own emissions and everything, and I've still got 50 tons in the corner of the shed, well, that's fine. That's for me to sell. So we're doing that. We are also, quite excitingly at the moment, we're starting to market and sell regeneratively farmed produce as well, and again that's something additional that we actually have a full audit process that farmers will have to go through to qualify for that, but then to be able to sell, whether it be their wheat or their porridge oats or whatever it may be, at a regenerative premium. So really those are the three main things that farmers, or four main things really, that farmers can get out of us, is the knowledge exchange, there's a regeneratively farmed produce, there's a carbon, and there's a biodiversity.
And Andrew, if people want to know more about the James Hutton Institute and the research that you've done, how can they find out more?
They can find out on the Hutton website. They can get in touch with us. I'm sure our comms team would happily be able to field any questions. And we also have events through the year, which any visitors we're happy to host at Arable Scotland, Potatoes in Practice, and Fruit for the Future events. So there's plenty of opportunity.
Thank you both for joining me today, guys. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. Been a pleasure talking to you and a pleasure listening as well. Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today for the Region Agri podcast. To learn more about what we've talked about in this episode, please find the links to the James Hutton Institute and the Green Farm Collective websites in the show notes. If you would like to know more about the Region Agri initiative and how we can help you on your regenerative journey, from advisory services, monitoring of on-farm data and regenerative certification through to carbon verification, please visit regionagri.org. You can also check out case studies and articles and gain access to our digital hub for free insight and advice. Alternatively, follow us on Twitter or Instagram at regionagri_org or search Region Agri on LinkedIn.